How ISIS Adapts, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. ISIS is losing ground in Syria and Iraq, but they're not giving up just yet.
ISIS are nothing if not adaptable in their propaganda and on the ground. The overall message at the moment seems to be the apocalypse is coming, but just not now.
Also, high school students here in Boston find out what it's like to become refugees.
It's really eye-opening, but like seeing everything that they go through and how different it is than what we go through, it's like incredible.
And a rising South African opera star recalls the moment when it all started.
I remember sitting there and listening to this girl singing. It just mesmerized me, and I was like, you know what? Next year I'm trying and I'm going to sing.
Those stories ahead on The World. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. We want to begin today with a check-in on the ongoing push to drive ISIS out of the Iraqi city of Mosul. In a minute, we'll find out what effect the fight is having on the ISIS propaganda machine. But first, let's focus on the human costs of the conflict. Clashes between Iraqi forces and ISIS militants are already beginning to displace residents from the villages around Mosul. Many head for the relative safety of Erbil, the capital of the autonomous Kurdistan region. And they're ending up in camps near the city, camps that are quickly filling up. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil has been to one of the biggest camps near Erbil.
The entrance to Debaga camp south of Erbil looks like an open market. There are people selling fruits, vegetables. There is a bakery where you can buy traditional Iraqi bread and a corner shop. Now, we understand that a group of people have arrived as recently as a few days ago, which means that they've either come on the first day of the Mosul offensive or maybe a few days after that. Now, many, we're told, are extremely reluctant to speak to the media, but I'm going to go and see if anybody's willing to speak to me about their experience.
Asad Hassan left his village south of Mosul a day before the offensive began. He tells a harrowing story of escape.
I left the day before the Mosul offensive began. It was a risk I had to take. The road out of my village was mined. There were two cars ahead of ours, and they were both blown up. We managed to escape to a Kurdish-controlled area, and we were brought to safety here. But I was extremely scared. I felt that I could be killed at any moment. Many civilians were caught up in the fighting between the Iraqi forces and the IS.
Tell me about your life under the so-called Islamic State. What was it like in the village?
There were no jobs, no proper places to study for my boys. Their education system is twisted. When they teach young children math, they say one bomb plus one bomb equals two bombs. Sometimes they show them how to assemble a bomb.
Have you yourself witnessed any violence by IS, Assad?
Yes, they caught one of my sons smoking. They started lashing him so hard that the skin came off his back.
Okay, this is what happens when you hold a microphone. It's surrounded by children. Marhaba. Ismik, what's your name?
Zaman.
10-year-old Zaman comes from Shiarat al-Imam, a village east of Mosul. She's been in the camp for 3 months with her mother and baby sister. Once we sat down surrounded by other children, she started telling me about what she saw. The IS militants killed men from the army, she said. I saw them kill a man. I was very scared. My dad is with the army too, and they threatened him. They said, you either join us or go to prison. They took him to prison. It's been 3 months now, and I haven't seen him, she tells me. She goes on to tell me about how she fled at night with her mom and her uncles, and how frightened she was.
And now that you're in this camp, you've been in this camp for a few months now, do you feel better or are you still scared? You're smiling. Feels better.
Now I feel much better. But I miss my dad, she says. He's been gone for months now, and I really want to see him. But with stories of horror, there's also joy in the camp. Many villages around Mosul have been cleared by the Iraqi and Kurdish Peshmerga forces. These refugees have just heard that their village has been retaken. But as the fighting continues, it'll be a long while before they can celebrate back home.
The BBC's Shama Khalil reporting from the Debaga camp outside of Erbil. The outcome of the Mosul offensive is anything but certain, but ISIS appears to be on its heels there. The group has also been suffering defeats elsewhere in recent weeks. In short, their caliphate is shrinking. But ISIS has always been good at propaganda, and so we wondered how they're spinning things. The World's Richard Hall has been looking into this from his perch in Beirut. And first, Richard, Mosul is the biggest city under ISIS control, so its loss would be a huge blow. But I understand the loss of a tiny Syrian village on Sunday might be much more significant for ISIS prestige. Tell us about Dabiq.
That's right. ISIS is having a very rough time of it at the moment. The reason Dabiq plays such an important role for ISIS is branding, believe it or not. Now, Dabiq, according to one reading of Sunni Islamic tradition, is supposed to be the site of the final apocalyptic battle between Muslims and Christian crusaders. So when ISIS captured the village, which is about 9 miles from the Turkish border in 2014, it was a huge deal for them. And believe it or not, a lot of people were attracted by this idea of being part of the apocalypse, a lot of disaffected young Muslims around the world. It was a very potent propaganda tool, and it gave its members some purpose, come and be part of the apocalypse, that kind of thing. Their propaganda as well features apocalyptic imagery. Their English language magazine is named after the village. So it was a very powerful recruitment tool for ISIS.
So the fact that they lost Dabiq without much of a fight must be a pretty big blow to their prestige. How's ISIS spinning it?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't look good. Well, so ISIS are nothing if not adaptable in their propaganda and on the ground. The overall message at the moment seems to be the apocalypse is coming, but just not now. I spoke to Shiraz Maher, who's a senior research fellow at King's College London. He studies ISIS supporters and ideology. This is what he said.
Part of their rationale is to say, well, you know, we make the effort, but God delivers results. So we tried our best and God, for whatever reason, chose for us not to have this victory. And so there's a fatalism that comes about.
That's kind of interesting because I imagine ISIS has to change its narrative. I mean, literally, their self-proclaimed caliphate is shrinking. So how are they changing it?
The message seems to be now that territory isn't everything. For a while now, ISIS has been urging its supporters in the West to carry out attacks at home rather than try and travel to the caliphate. So it was a big change from the beginning when we're actually capturing territory and saying, come to us because we are the caliphate. Now they're saying, carry out attacks at home, don't come here, territory isn't everything.
So are we even close to the final days of the Islamic State?
I don't think so. I mean, like I say, ISIS is adapting. It may not be the same organization it was a couple of years ago, but it's adaptable and it's making changes. And we're likely to see a different kind of organization, one that carries out attacks abroad, focuses on insurgency, terrorist attacks, rather than capturing territory. This is what Shiraz said.
It's not clear to me what success will necessarily look like. You know, we tend to think of IS in these sort of static terms. Are they a state? Are they this? I mean, the point is they can be a solid, liquid and gas all at the same time, i.e. they are a terrorist group, they are an insurgency, and they're a protest state. So losing territory will just mean they will morph back into various, nonetheless, quite potent forms. So I think we're a long, long way from the end.
Richard, do we know if these losses by ISIS and these defeats have had any impact on their recruitment?
It's very hard to say. There's been a number of factors contributing to a lack of foreign fighters getting to the Islamic State. The border between Syria and Turkey was recently closed down completely. There were still gaps before. So that in itself might have had a bigger impact on foreign fighters actually traveling to the Islamic State. What this may have affected more is its ability to attract supporters elsewhere. So people who may have carried out attacks in Europe or in America that may have been attracted to ISIS because it's this successful group and because of its prophecies seem to be coming true, they might be less attracted to the group now because it turned out not to be true.
The World's Richard Hall in Beirut. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks, Kara.
I'm in charge of our satire desk here at The World, and that means I look at a lot of cartoons. One nonfiction comic book that caught my eye recently is called Rolling Blackouts, Dispatches from Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. It's by cartoonist Sarah Glidden. The book was a result of a trip she took in 2010 with some journalist friends who went to the Middle East to report on refugees. Glidden remembers one displaced Iraqi couple she met named Momo and Odessa.
They were a really wonderful couple. I actually am still in touch with them. They've been since resettled to British Columbia. Meeting them was, just like meeting someone who was already your friend. They were both artists, both painters, and Momo is also a cartoonist, working on a memoir about growing up in Baghdad and then, you know, being a young man when the invasion happened and then his escape to Syria. One thing that I wanted to show in this book is that you could be a refugee if you were in a different place at a different time. You know, this is someone who a lot of my readers can identify with. I know I identified with, and yet here he is fearing for his safety. He was separated from his friends. He couldn't do the work that he used to do, separated from his family, some of whom are still in danger, and just how impossible it is to imagine being in his position.
You also meet an Iranian blogger. Tell us about him.
Yes, this was someone we met in southeastern Turkey. He had actually not been jailed for blogging. That's what I assumed when I heard that we were going to meet an Iranian blogger who had been to Evin prison and who had escaped over the mountains with his wife into Turkey. But it turned out that he had been publishing books that weren't approved by the government, and he was put in jail because he was being questioned over those. We spoke to him at length. He was the first refugee that we had interviewed because we came to Turkey first. And through him and his wife, we really learned a lot about the refugee process, how the UNHCR takes cases and works on resettlement, and a lot of the frustrations that come with that waiting period that he was going through. This was within the first week or so of me being on this trip with these journalists, and I realized how many of my own assumptions I bring to people based on what I know about their country, what I know, the limited amount of information that I've gotten from the news. You just hear about someone and you assume why they've been in jail. You kind of assume their story. So that was kind of a big lesson for me right away that, you know, you need to have the interview first. You need to actually talk to someone before you think you know what their story is.
Did you draw on location or when you got back?
The book is all drawn when I got back because when all of this is happening, you really don't have time to sit and draw, although I wish I would. It would be so much more romantic for me to be able to sit and do these paintings on site. But I do use the sketchbook at times when I can't take photographs. Border crossings are a good example, or sometimes more intimate interviews where it would be inappropriate for me to take pictures. I'll do drawings then, but mostly I take a lot of pictures so that I can be very specific about the place. I want people to be able to recognize Damascus or recognize Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq when they read the book.
What does cartooning bring to this kind of endeavor that writing wouldn't?
You know, right now we're really bombarded by articles and photographs every single day, you know, on your Facebook feed. I think sometimes people feel desensitized to these stories about war and hardship. I think that comics can make people look again, because right now, nonfiction comics are still relatively new, and hand-drawn images and hand-painted images might make someone take a second look instead of another photograph. So I think that I can kind of, like, grab people and lure them in, and then once they're there, I hope that the comics being hand-drawn and, you know, showing a human touch can kind of give someone an intimate connection to an issue that might be more difficult when there's like a mechanical layer between them and the story, as with prose or photographs. So I think that comics can bring a real human connection and can kind of be a gateway drug to an issue for people.
Sarah Glidden is a cartoonist. Her latest comics journalism effort is called Rolling Blackouts, Dispatches from Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. Sarah, thanks so much for coming in to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up later on the show, the Scottish woman who designed a better diaper. You're with The World. We're going to spend the next few minutes talking about South Africa. Coming up, we'll profile one of the country's rising opera stars. But first, a quick note about South Africa and something called the International Criminal Court. The ICC, as it's called, was created in 2002. Its main purpose is to investigate war crimes and bring those responsible to justice. And here's the thing. South Africa's post-apartheid government pushed for years to help establish the court. But now South Africa, along with several other African nations, are expressing serious doubts about the usefulness of the ICC.
Critics say the court unfairly targets African leaders and fails to respect diplomatic immunity laws. Last year, when the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, visited South Africa, there were calls for him to be arrested. That's because the ICC had issued an arrest warrant for Bashir on war crimes charges. But South Africa's government, under President Jacob Zuma, refused to detain the Sudanese leader and allowed him to leave the country. Now South Africa's parliament looks likely to pass a bill that would officially end the country's involvement with the ICC. And that saddens Richard Goldstone. He's a former South African judge who served as chief prosecutor for the United Nations tribunals held on Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. Goldstone says the notion that African leaders have been unfairly targeted by the court is false.
The ICC has been engaged by Africa. Of the 10 situations before the ICC at the moment, six have come at the instance of African governments. Only two have been the result of the prosecutor using his or her own initiative, and two others have come from the United Nations Security Council. So to say that the ICC is targeting Africa is really without any foundation, in my view.
But South Africa's ruling ANC party is pushing to quit the court. It says the ICC caters to the imperialist agenda of countries that don't even belong to the International Criminal Court. And in case you're wondering, the United States is one of them. Okay, let's switch gears and talk about music in South Africa. The country's got a rich choral tradition, and in recent years, that's produced a wave of talented opera singers who are making their marks on stages across the globe. The latest rising star is 25-year-old Nolavaiso Mpofu. From Cape Town, Kim Cloutie has our story.
I meet up with Nolavaiso at the College of Music at the University of Cape Town. She's been studying here for a few years, but her journey began in a township in the coastal city of Port Elizabeth, a day's drive east of here.
We grew up in the same house, my mom, my granny, my cousins, my aunt, Mia, a big family.
The region she's from, the Eastern Cape, has been called the vocal breadbasket of South Africa. Nolavaiso joined a choir when she was in primary school, but she didn't hear opera performed until she attended a singing competition when she was well into high school.
I remember sitting there and listening to this girl singing, and I remember just being fascinated by the language, the costumes, the music itself. It just mesmerized me, and I was like, you know what, next year I'm trying and I'm going to sing.
Nolavaiso went to the local library to find out more about this beautiful but somewhat alien sound. She started entering competitions, scooping second prize in a national schools competition. Then she auditioned for a coveted spot at the opera school at the University of Cape Town. Voice coach Patrick Tekolo was blown away.
There's that kind of glowing femininity in her singing, in the voice itself. You just cannot ignore that kind of a voice.
She was accepted at the university. She started mailing DVD recordings of her student performances to her mother.
She used to brag about me, take the DVDs to everyone in our street and make them watch me and stuff. She was very proud.
But early into her time as a student, Nolavaiso's mother died. While miles away and grieving, she had to step up.
My little brothers were about 2 and 5 when my mom passed. And then after that, I was like, okay, you know what? You are the one who's going to support your family now. So pull up your socks, push yourself. And then that's what I've been doing ever since.
Last year, she came third in the prestigious International Operalia competition hosted by Placido Domingo in London. And then the World Cup of Opera, the International Hans Gabor Belvedere Singing Competition, came to Cape Town. But things weren't looking auspicious for Nolavaiso. A bout of flu nearly knocked her out of the competition. And then, 2 days before the performance, a man mugged her as she walked home from the theatre.
He stood in front of me and that took out a knife. And then he was like, give me your phone, give me money, give me everything. At the time that it was happening, I just told myself, stay calm, because the previous day someone got stabbed in the same vicinity. So I was like, okay, stay calm, give him what he wants, and then I went home. And then when I went home, oh my word, I cried. I think I was shocked.
But Nolavaiso put her nerves aside and plunged into the Donizetti aria she had chosen.
it's a life of an artist. You have to go back. You have to get there, and just, the show must go on. You have no time to just cry, and yeah, maybe a few seconds of crying, and then you'll be, and then you're back on your game.
And she was. Once again, she made it to the finals, and she was delighted when the judging panel asked her to sing an aria from Verdi's La Traviata.
Traviata, Violetta, the character, it's my favourite, one of my favourite operas.
When she told me this aria was selected for her, I said, you know what? It's God's call. She was like an angel on that stage. She was sparkling. She sang with such poise. It was no wonder for me to see people loving her that much. It said it all to me that, yes, this is where she's supposed to be.
Nonna Viyiso won the second prize overall, the audience prize, and the best South African singer in the competition. She brought the house down.
It was overwhelming. My dream is to sing all over the world, just to share what I have with people. That is my dream.
So you see, this is definitely your future.
This is definitely my future. This is definitely what I want to do, and I do not imagine myself doing anything else.
Nonna Viyiso's future looks promising, but competition is tough. For now, she's still waiting for that big-time call to the international stage. For The World, Kim Clutie, Cape Town.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. Sana Mir is out to change perceptions about her country.
Outside Pakistan, a lot of people thought women are not allowed to do stuff in Pakistan.
Mir was going to be an engineer, but she became a professional cricket player instead, and her father approved.
He said, we've got a lot of female engineers, we don't have a lot of female cricketers.
Her story, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Ni una menos, not one woman less. That's what people in Argentina and across Latin America have been saying this week, loudly, both on the streets and online. The phrase is a plea for an end to violence against women, and it's linked to the brutal gang rape and murder of a 16-year-old Argentinian girl named Lucia Perez. Jasmine Garst is a reporter for our Across Women's Lives project. She says that deaths like Lucia's are all too common.
This isn't a one-time thing. This level of violence against women has really been at the forefront of women's movements in Argentina. It's been an issue for quite a while. And I feel like the brutality of this case, it just sparked these massive protests.
How long has this been an issue? Are we talking about years that there's been a rise in violence against women?
I don't know that there's been a rise. I think there's been a rise in consciousness. You know, I'm from Argentina. I remember as a kid cases like these, really brutal cases. And I remember this really oppressive sexism, you know, from all ends. Like, I remember men on the street saying things that were really disgusting and disturbing to me. And I remember my own family saying, you know, don't dress like that. You don't want to get raped. But I think in recent years, there's been a rise in a very vocal consciousness. And it's not just, quote unquote, feminist activists. It's everyday women that are saying, you know what, I've had it.
Is there any sense among men in Argentina that they're the perpetrators? And where is this attitude developing? Where is this starting?
Well, yes and no. I've been really pleasantly surprised by a lot of male friends of mine that I've seen on Facebook discussing, you know, what is going on? What can we do differently? And I think, again, the nature of this case was so brutal that it would be really hard for someone to say this was in any way okay. Although there were voices who, in the wake of this case, said, well, you know, what did she expect talking to two older men? So I'd say it's divided. You know, there's an incredible sexism and violence against women in the region. That's a reality.
That's what I was going to follow up with is these protests are happening in Argentina, but is it a regional issue?
I think Argentina has a culture of going out into the streets and protesting. What is interesting is that, you know, there's a survey that the UN cites called the Small Arms Survey, and it found that at least half of the countries with high femicide rates are in Latin America. And when we think of femicide, I think when Americans think of violence against women, a lot of times they think of the Middle East, they think of Africa. But actually, it's a huge problem in Central America. El Salvador is the country with the highest rates of gender-based killings in the world. Now, this protest, many other countries got on the bandwagon. Countries in Central America, you had Chile, you had Peru, Mexico. It definitely is a regional problem, and I think there's a growing awareness of it.
Are these protests at the street level, sort of social media stage, or is the government in Argentina recognizing there's a problem and trying to make change?
I think the governments throughout Latin America have recognized that there are problems with this, and there have been some progressive laws in the last couple of years. And even, you know, in Central America, you have like a UN protocol in El Salvador that was installed for judging and investigating these cases. But, you know, I think it's both ways, right? I mean, it has to be top-bottom. The government has to address it, but also it's a societal issue.
What are the next steps?
That protest was massive. In Buenos Aires, you had thousands of women under the pouring rain with umbrellas coming out and saying, we have had it. Basta. Definitely there's going to be an eye on the case as it moves forward. And I think at the very least, this has reignited an ongoing dialogue.
I always find it interesting with issues that, you know, women are the victims, yet somehow they're supposed to change things. It always seems to me that until men get involved and take it seriously, it doesn't seem like much is going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think sexism is a very complex problem all around the world. I'm always really wary of saying it's a Latin American problem, machismo. I mean, not to take it there, but there's a presidential candidate right now that has talked about grabbing women by the genitalia. So I would hardly say that sexism is a Latin American problem.
Oh, no. I think it's an equal opportunity problem.
Yes, absolutely.
Jasmine Garz is a reporter for our Across Women's Lives project. She's also from Argentina. Thanks so much, Jasmine.
Thank you for having me.
I just didn't want to wash them. That's the simple explanation Valerie Hunter Gordon always gave when asked why she designed what is arguably the world's first disposable diaper, or nappies, as they're called in Britain. Valerie Hunter Gordon died this week at the age of 94. Scottish journalist Anna Burnside met her last year for one of her final interviews. Anna joins me from Glasgow. Anna, so back in the 1940s, what were Scottish and English women using for diapers or nappies?
It was a horrible labor-intensive system of terry toweling, a thick absorbent toweling material, which you folded up and pinned together, and then you put on top, you put rubber pants. And all of these things had to be soaked in a bucket and then washed and dried. And it was a ghastly, smelly, if I can say that, horrible process that was a chore and a bind for women. Valerie, it was her nature wasn't just to think, oh, this is awful, you know, I hate that bucket of nappies. Her instinct was to think, surely there must be something better than this. And so she started thinking about it. And that's when she came up with an alternative.
And of course, this is post-war, a time of shortages of everything. And Valerie Hunter Gordon had three kids. So this was just a huge time-consuming thing with the regular diapers. What were her initial prototypes like for an alternative?
Well, I've actually seen some of these prototypes. They were made from parachute silk. She was an army wife. Her husband had come home from the forces and he was teaching at a military college. So she looked around at what was available and she alighted on this parachute silk, this light fabric. So she began to make prototypes on her Singer sewing machine. I have seen the very sewing machine. She still had it when I went to see her last year. She started sewing these, put her own son, Nigel, who was the wee one at the time, put him in those. And of course, her social life was all going on what we would now call play dates and coffee dates with all the other young mums on the Air Force base. And they all saw Nigel in his smart new pants and nappy that his mum had made him and were, of course, interested and wanted ones for themselves.
What's interesting is around the same time she was inventing this alternative to the cloth diaper, there was an American woman, Marion Donovan, and I guess she's credited with making the first fully disposable diaper. It's interesting they were both women post-war working on this thing that directly affected them.
Well, why wouldn't you? I mean, why would you put up with the drudgery of washing nappies? I'm amazed. I would be amazed if there wasn't a woman or women in every single, you know, developed country who were sitting at their Singer sewing machine wrestling up something similar to this. I think it was inevitable that something like this would be invented. And in fact, it was the arrival of Pampers in the UK market that killed off the Paddy, which was the name that Valerie's nappy was marketed under. So Paddy died a death.
Now, you met Valerie Hunter Gordon. What was she like?
Oh, she was fantastic. She was one of these tiny little bird-like ladies, quite small and frail, but she was a great character. We did photographs. She got out the Singer sewing machine that she made the original nappies on. She had all these prototypes and literature and leaflets and so on from the cupboard, and she got them all out. She was super fun. She had 19 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren and two more on the way. So I wouldn't be surprised if there had been even more by the time she sadly died.
Scottish journalist Anna Burnside has been talking to us about Valerie Hunter Gordon, the inventor of one of the first disposable diapers. Thanks so much, Anna.
You're welcome.
Europe's ongoing refugee crisis can sometimes feel distant until you suddenly find it on your doorstep. Here's reporter Anders Kelto.
So I'm down in the Boston Harbor, and it's a beautiful day. There's people strolling up and down along the pier. There's these huge cruise ships taking people out on tours of the Boston Harbor. And then at the end of the pier, there's what appears to be a refugee camp, a bunch of white tents set up and staff from Doctors Without Borders walking around in matching white T-shirts. What's your name?
Tatiana Chiarella.
Tatiana Chiarella is a nurse from Brazil. She's been working for Doctors Without Borders for about 3 years. And she spent much of that time in areas with a lot of refugees.
I've been Malawi, after I went South Sudan, also Africa, then Yemen, Libya, and I just come back from Syria border.
Now she's in Boston, working at this traveling exhibit. The idea is to show people what it's like to be a refugee on the move. Today, a group of high school students are taking the tour.
Grace Steves.
And?
Irene Koyston.
And what grade are you guys?
I'm a junior, and I'm a senior.
What's your guys' impression of, like, what's happening in Syria right now? Do you follow it? Are you aware of what's happening? Are you interested?
I think I'm interested, but it's kind of hard to learn about it, because it's, especially in the media that we use, like, it's just not represented, and they don't talk about it at all.
What's the media that you follow? Like, where do you get your news?
Facebook, Instagram, or like Twitter, or whatever, like get a lot of stuff from that, but I feel like those places just don't accurately represent a lot of the stuff that's happening in the world.
They show me their Facebook feeds on their phones, and sure enough, there's not a lot of global news.
A lot of it's just my mom sharing stuff on my timeline.
Wait, let's see. Let's see one.
There is a video of how to make chocolate covered apples, and then, homecoming.
Did your mom post that homecoming pic?
Yeah.
Are you going to have to cut her off at some point?
Yeah, definitely.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. Ah, now much better.
The Brazilian nurse, Tatiana Chiarella, welcomes the students to the exhibit. She tells them, close your eyes and imagine you're living in a war-torn country. All of a sudden, you're under attack. You only have time to grab 5 things.
Let's go, let's go. It's emergency. Remember, let's go. 5 items. Quick, 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 quick.
But wait, Chiarella says. There's not enough room. You can only bring 4 things. Grace Steves makes her choices.
I have the blanket, the clothes, the water, the passport, and the medicine.
And which one did you ditch?
The blanket.
How come?
Because I thought the water was important, obviously, because you have to stay hydrated. The passport to travel between countries, the medicine for if you're sick, and the clothes can also serve the purposes, keeping you warm. So I thought the blanket was the least important.
The students then pile into a boat, an actual motorboat, like the ones many refugees use on dangerous ocean crossings. They're told to imagine being crammed in there for 3 days. And they have to pay the driver with another item they're carrying. And so which one did you ditch now?
I ditched the clothes.
How come?
I guess, assuming that you have what was already on your body, I just thought try to like make it through with that and keep the 3 most important ones.
The students cross a simulated border. They feel just how heavy a 50-pound jug of water is. They learn how to use a pit toilet. And they hear about all the dangers they face.
You can get easily sick. Maybe you don't have clean water, you don't have enough food, you are exposed to elements, you have mosquitoes, you have snakes.
And finally, an hour after they started, the students arrive at a simulated refugee camp. Grace Steves has only 1 item left.
I decided to keep the water. I figured it was sort of like a life or death matter, and this would, in the long run, help me the most.
More than, what did you give up?
Passport. Because that's more like my identity. This is saving like my whole entire life as a refugee.
The students follow Tatiana Chiarella into a white tent. There are blankets laid out on the ground and homemade toys scattered everywhere.
So as you can see, it's crowded, huh? Could you imagine we live all together here?
Chiarella says that even these refugee camps can be dangerous. One of the biggest problems is that people cook over fires right inside the tents. They get sick from breathing in the smoke.
You also have children running everywhere, so we have many domestic accidents. Like women, children get burns because of this.
I catch up with high school student Grace Steves one last time. How do you feel when you're going through this? I mean, is it...
It's like... fascinating, but it's scary. Like, it's really eye-opening, but like seeing everything that they go through and how different it is than what we go through, it's like incredible.
Steves exits the tent, and walking back to the bus, she tells me she'll definitely post about her experience today on Facebook. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Boston.
We've got some photos of that Doctors Without Borders exhibit. You can check them out at PRI.org. By the way, the exhibit's called Forced from Home. And after Boston, it heads to Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Pakistan's not an easy place to be a woman, especially if you're a woman trying to play what's widely considered a man's sport. I'm talking about the game of cricket. And the woman? Well, you're about to meet her in the first of a series of stories we have for you out of Pakistan. It's part of our Across Women's Lives reporting project. More on the series in a few minutes. First, here's The World's Carolyn Beeler. Her story begins in Lahore.
So I'm an American, and the only thing I knew about the game of cricket until about a week ago was that they take a break for tea in the middle of the match. So when the most famous woman in Pakistani sports agreed very nicely to show me how to throw, or bowl actually, a cricket ball, it was a little embarrassing.
All right, here goes. Yeah, nice try. But you did bend the elbow a little bit.
Oh. That's Sana Mir. She's the captain of the Pakistani women's cricket team, and at 30 years old, already a veteran. She hands me back the ball. It's like a small baseball.
You just keep this elbow straight.
Okay.
And bring this hand as straight as possible. Better.
Yeah. We're at the Lahore Country Club. Behind us, pitchers are running toward batters and hurling the ball. The batters knock them away with big, flat wooden bats.
When I started off, there were hardly any girls playing cricket, so it was on the streets with my bigger brother where I learned.
Mir's father was in the army, so they moved a lot. And every time they did, she had to prove herself to the neighborhood boys to keep playing the game.
All those tests that I had to give in every city and every team show that I have got cricket in me, and that made my belief stronger that I am better at cricket than many other things.
And in Pakistan, that means something. The sport is huge here. Imagine the popularity of football, baseball, and basketball all rolled into one, and you've got cricket. In 2003, Mir gave up a spot at an engineering university to pursue cricket full-time. She got a push from her father.
He said that we have got a lot of female engineers, we don't have a lot of female cricketers.
Since choosing sports over academics, Mir has helped build up Pakistan's first professional women's cricket team. As captain, she's led the team to wins in big international tournaments and against neighbor and longtime rival India. The team's up-and-coming bowler, Maham Tariq, attributes a lot of their success to Mir's leadership.
I have no words to express. She's so amazing. In fact, on the field and off the field, her attitude, she's so always motivated. Playing under her captaincy, I think I can't ask for more.
Mir says she's most proud of how her team's performance has affected the country off the field.
There are two kinds of perceptions we have been able to change. One is that Pakistani women can't play cricket or any sport. This was the perception we changed inside Pakistan.
And elsewhere, she says,
outside Pakistan, a lot of people thought that women are not allowed to do stuff in Pakistan. So that is another perception that we have been very proudly able to change.
Even though it's getting more acceptable for women to play cricket, it's still not exactly easy. There are no dedicated fields for women, and they don't have the same cricket clubs as men. Women's participation in all sports is low here. No Pakistani woman has ever won a medal in the Olympics. So Mir says supportive families who encourage pushing the boundaries of acceptability are key in striving for equality.
These girls are here not because these girls wanted to change something, but their families, their fathers, their brothers, their parents, their mothers wanted to change. So this is something that's really encouraging for me to see.
Yesterday, I drove around Islamabad trying to find girls playing cricket to ask them if Mir was a role model for them, but I couldn't find any. So I surveyed a bunch of college guys getting pumped up for a match. Have you ever heard of Sana Mir?
Sana Mir.
Sana Mir, Pakistani cricket captain.
This is Sameed Akbar.
She's a good player. Her family support her, and she also performed really well in domestic and in streets as well.
But when I asked if any of them had ever played with a girl?
No. I have never played cricket with girls, just boys.
No.
No.
There's still a lot of work to be done for women's cricket. But for now, it's game time.
I have a match and talk to you later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Bye. Good luck.
Carolyn Beeler there in Islamabad for our Across Women's Lives reporting project. She's on the line with me now. And Carolyn, that's the first of a few stories you've got for us over the next week or so. What else can we expect to hear?
Well, we are launching on Monday a series that we are calling Balance of Power. And for our stories from Pakistan, we're going to be looking at how policy decisions that are made in the U.S. are impacting women all the way over here in Pakistan. And part of the reason why we're doing that is because the U.S. for the past several years has really made it a priority to try to include gender and gender equality and women's issues in all of their planning around defense and security and development. So we're going to be sort of telling the stories of some women who are impacted by that in a lot of different ways.
So give us a preview. What kind of women have you been meeting?
Well, today I did a ride along with a cop, a motorways police officer named Asma Naqvi. And she's a senior patrol officer with the motorways police here and one of two female officers out of 52 in her department. So it's pretty rare. And she sort of told me that she has dreamt of being in law enforcement for a long time, since she was a little girl growing up in northern Pakistan.
In fact, you know, when I was a kid, everybody was playing, the young girls, my cousins and friends, they were playing with the dolls and these things, right? So I never bought any doll. I always bought a pistol or a car or something like this.
So as you can tell, even when she was a little kid, this career was calling to her.
Carolyn, what would you say has surprised you or struck you the most in your reporting from Pakistan so far?
Well, Carol, I think coming from the U.S., what has really struck me is that in this place where it's not especially easy to be a woman and where men and women exist in pretty different spheres, at least in a lot of the country, there are so many very ambitious and confident women who are sort of making it work and doing sort of what they want to do and getting what they want to get out of their careers sort of within this system. And another thing that really surprised me this week was this musician that we met. Sky could fall on me. This is music from Rutaba Yaqub, who actually grew up in Saudi Arabia and moved to Pakistan for the freedom and the freedom to pursue her music. So that was also surprising to me.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. That was the world's Carolyn Beeler in Islamabad. Let's go out with a bit more music from Rutaba Yaqub. Our own theme music is composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. You're a sky full of stars.
RI, Public Radio International.